Hey, it's David Greenwald.
And hey, it's Dom Sinicola.
And this is Pretty Little Grown Men, the
pod. Who cares?
We're going to leave that in. We don't do edits on this show. The Podfectionists. Secret, can you keep it? Taking this one to the grave. And we're back.
So, Dave, it's okay that you flubbed that opening because guess what?
Why is that?
It's dead week.
It's dead week. We're stressed. We're eating carbs. Yeah. We're studying hard. I have to say, I feel very distracted watching this episode because I just saw the Avengers movie and Game of Thrones was just really crazy this week. And so watching this episode, it's like, oh, right, we're still watching the show that we do an hour-long podcast about every week.
There's only so much capacity in our emotional lives to take so many character developments.
That's true.
Although this was a, as the episode description on Hulu said, it is a week for the perfectionists to start getting their personal lives back in order.
Yeah, I like this episode. It was charming. Some interesting things happened with the characters, which I felt deepened our connections to them, particularly Dylan, who you know, gets to make some good choices, and we get to see him reconcile with his boyfriend, and you know, we get to relate to him a little bit more.
Well, he made an ultimately bad choice.
He did, but he makes a very human choice, and I felt like this episode was kind of about the characters.
It was all about being human.
Yeah, it was. It was about screwing up and figuring it out, and
just being a person in this crazy world.
Indeed, they tried to do that with Caitlin, and I guess I just am not interested in her as a character. It's like, what if Spencer Hastings was like way less charming, or just like way less interesting? You know?
Yes.
I mean, no. You know, I think the actress is doing her best, but the character itself, I just don't think is that interesting.
There are a number of weird meta moments on this episode that sort of put into a more self-aware perspective a lot of our I think. Qualms with the TV show. Like, for example, the fact that it's been hard to care about these new characters, and part of that reason is because we don't really know who they are.
Right.
And it's like, here's an episode about how no one knows who they are, including themselves.
Right. We were watching this, so Caitlin goes in for her interview for Senator Hastings' office, and all these kids are waiting outside. They're all dressed up, and somebody says, it's her. We should just go home. She doesn't even sleep.
She was loving that.
Yeah,
she was
knew loving it. Yeah, that was great. So she has her reputation, which is cool. And she comes in, and the interviewer is like, yeah, I don't really give a shit. Tell me if you like pizza or tacos. Like, tell me that you're like an actual human being.
Yeah.
And I paused the episode because I was really aggravated by this, because it took me back to being in high school where you have to write your personal essay. This is, you know, 5 million years ago, so I don't know what it's like for kids today, but you have to write your personal essay about some, you know, experience, life-changing experience, or some mountain that you have climbed, literal or figurative, some life challenge. And it's like, how about the fact that I studied really hard? How about, like, I was the president of this club or whatever it is? And it's like, you were expected to have this as just the baseline to get into one of these top colleges. Like, it's just expected that you work 5 million hours and have straight A's and did all this other stuff on top of it and then still have time to, like, be a person having an inner life.
Well, that's what's frustrating, is because it's so counterintuitive, where it's like, you expect them to have this experience and this drive and this, you know, near obsession with work, but you want them to have a life outside of that. And it's like, of course they can't have a fucking life outside of that. I mean, granted, it's ridiculous that, like, if someone asked me tacos or pizza, I would have an answer for it. But I understand that she's taken aback by it, because it's like, I don't have a pet because I don't have fucking time to take care of a pet.
Right. It's like, she's in college.
Right.
Like, why would like, who cares if she's
who are you? I'm a person who's studying all the fucking time.
Right.
Who are you, lady?
Right. Exactly. I mean, I appreciate that she turns it around and says, you know, you have to relate to constituents and blah, blah, blah. But it's just like, okay. I mean,
well, the best scene with Caitlin so far, was where she had that epiphany, like, as she's like, you know, reeling from a bad interview and talking to the waiter and, you know, having this like insane order.
Right.
Which it's like, that was a point in the episode. It's like, maybe being around Caitlin sucks. Like maybe right. being her friend sucks.
Right. Like maybe you're a bad character. maybe you're too neurotic.
But that's the thing is like, that was the first time that you really got a huge dose of like just how neurotic she is.
Right.
And it's like, that felt real. It felt like when you see like Mona going through like an episode, like a manic episode or something, and you're just like that, well, that's human. You see flaws in this person, on this show about characters finally discovering that they have flaws.
Right, right.
That it's okay to have flaws.
Grappling with your own limitations and pressure and all that stuff. Yeah, I mean, these are interesting themes. And I thought, you know, it was very authentic to me that the interviewer is asking these shitty questions and, like, not wanting to dwell on this person's accomplishments and just basically, like, throwing a resume out the window.
Right.
And being like, but I want to, like you. You know, I like the idea of like electing a president who you would have a beer with. It's like, that's not what this is.
Right.
That's not, you know, but
exactly.
I mean, but that it's an interesting lesson for the perfectionists and for everyone to learn that your accomplishments on paper are often secondary to your ability to be likable and network and have people want to be around you. And then that gives them opportunities to give you money.
Right. You know, it's the same thing with Dylan's whole hurdy hand, his inability to play. Like, you know, it's he doesn't know if it's permanent, and it probably wouldn't be permanent if he fucking like put some ice on that thing or something. Like you just see him rubbing it.
Obsessively. It's like, do some physical therapy.
Yeah, like, come on, man. Like it's not.
But he's got this scholarship, so for him the stakes are really high. And I felt like this episode did get into that and made us feel what the stakes are for him,
mm-hmm.
you know, because he is this kid who got out of his, you know, bummer middle American town where you're not going to want to be an out gay person. And he's on this scholarship to this amazing school. And if he can't make it work, what is he going to do? Go back home?
Right.
You know? So he's really in a bind and willing to, you understand why he's willing to make these choices.
Yeah. But I mean, come on, if you're going to cheat like that, at least friggin' listen to the file before you send it.
Yeah.
I mean, he just recorded it straight and sent it.
Just the, you know.
9.3 megabytes.
It just goes into the sort of suspension of belief thing you have to have with this show, where he does this thing on his computer and he sends it to the professor, and suddenly Dana Booker or whatever mystery villain is able to get the recording and put it on the internet, put it on the speakers or whatever. It's just like, I mean, okay, I mean. It gives you the illusion of the all-powerful villain, but I don't know. It's kind of tedious.
I mean, I want to take a step back and look at the bigger thing here, which is like, you know, now I do appreciate the other meta thing that I wanted to mention was that something that we've talked about so many times, which is that whoever the group of protagonists are, be it the liars or the perfectionists, they fixate on who they think is the villain and they won't let it go. And they're like, I'm sure it's this person. And then, of course, it's never that person. But in this episode, Mona calls them out on it. And it's just like, you have no evidence that it's this person. What evidence you do have is, you know, tenuous at best. And so, like, you don't actually know who this is, so shut up. Like, you shut up, kids.
Right, right. It's great. I mean, that whole scene is amazing, and they're talking about A and how A was making Hannah eat all those cupcakes, and somebody, one of the kids, one of the perfectionists, is like, who's A? And Mona raised her hand.
Yeah.
A+. I mean, this is why we're watching the show.
I mean, yes, this episode is so much better than last week's when it comes to getting some good Allie Mona stuff. And even, like... Oh, and the other thing was that Mona is basically telling Allie, like, you know, the reason that you're in this dramatic shit right now is it's your fault. It's because you won't leave, like, essentially saying, like, I understand that you're traumatized by this, but you can make your life better.
But this is an ironic position for Mona to be taking, given that she's literally the person who recruited Allie, probably knowing that her algorithm had found her for the specific purpose of replacing this dead girl.
True. Mona did know that she's basically bringing Allie into a weird situation.
And I also
but
feel
it did help to have somebody finally tell Allie, like, snap out of it. Like, this is fucking crazy what
no,
you're doing.
This was a very healthy thing for Allie to hear, but it was also a totally wild thing for Mona to be the person telling her, as well as all the stuff Mona is saying about the mini Beacon Guard stuff, because we know that she is in touch with, like, the secret surveillance people, mm-hmm. which has not been touched on for this. It's this underlying thread that's sitting under the entire season, and maybe the show will abandon it and just be like, no, we'd change our minds.
Yeah.
Which would, you know, would not surprise me if they did that, honestly, because we've seen that before. But why would you drop that in the premiere and show, have this big reveal with Mona, if that isn't something you're supposed to be keeping in your mind
right.
as you see her dealing with Allie and so on?
Well, see, here's, so I was trying to do what the characters on the show aren't really doing, which is give a shit about who killed Noel.
Right.
Or Nolan.
Right.
And Noel.
Noel Kahn.
We know who killed Noel Kahn. It was himself.
Get going, buddy.
Because it honestly, like, it just seems like they've just completely gotten over giving a shit about who has killed Nolan. Like, there's no police investigation. Dana Booker doesn't even seem to really give much of a shit about it anymore.
She's just, like, hanging out drinking coffee in the fucking quad. I mean, yeah. The Dana Booker thing is wild because she has no assistants. There's nobody else on. It's like there's no other security person on staff. She's just, like, the lone detective lady who's going to solve this case. And it's like, is this what Claire Hotchkiss thought really? Is this how she wants to investigate her son's death? Which is this fucking random former FBI agent?
So, and I have to mention, this isn't what I wanted to talk about, but I have to mention something that I obviously brought up that we both saw, which is when Dana Booker tells Caitlin that her hit and run case has been solved. And it's like, in any normal society, the police would have contacted Caitlin and asked if she wanted to press charges, she would have been the first person that they contacted.
Right.
They wouldn't
Absolutely.
Have a person who is not a police officer tell Caitlin, or not her family, like a total stranger, and in fact, in many cases, an antagonist. They wouldn't have the police department wouldn't have Dana Booker go tell Caitlin, which it's like whatever. Like there are so many. At this point, we can't focus on the one major
literally glaring. Any plot details.
Well, it's just like the whole police thing in this, you can either like let it bother you, which I do quite often, or you can accept it as this weird, surreal part of this surreal world that these people inhabit.
Right.
I mean, if that were really the case, then I'd say, and push it further into absurdity, like be more absurd, be more dreamlike, be more David Lynchian if you really want to push it.
Why are we not seeing more surveillance-y things?
Right.
Like, yeah, I mean, there's all this potential, and you know, there was a really nice shot in the beginning of the show. I think Ava is like walking into her, no, is it Mona?
It's Mona.
She's walking into her room. She thinks Nolan is there or someone has broken into her room. And it's really beautifully shot. And there is this real artistic sensibility to the direction. And
we should mention that it was directed by Arlene Sanford.
Yeah, so wonderful shot.
Who is, she directed a Very Brady sequel.
Oh, okay, well.
The movie. Stephanie. She's also directed a ton of TV, Weeds, Boston Legal, Desperate Housewives, Everwood, Gilmore Girls, Malcolm in the Middle, West Wing. She got nominated for 2 Emmys for Ally McBeal, an episode of Friends. Anyway, she obviously is it's like what we've been saying about all the directors and people who work on the show. They're all like old hands on these like serialized thriller-ish dramas.
Right. So it's a really well-made show. I mean, the aesthetics of the show, I think, are the visual aesthetic of the show is really great.
That one shot you're thinking about, I immediately thought of a movie called The Night of the Hunter.
Uh-huh.
Have you heard of this movie?
No.
It's Charles Laughton from 1955. Is the only movie that Charles Laughton made. It stars Robert Mitchum, I think. It's been a while since I've seen it, but it's a very good movie, and it's got that sort of like German expressionism shadows,
yeah,
kind of thing.
I love that.
Which is just like, yeah, like really dark, deep shadows. Characters are often like silhouettes, lit really strangely, but really compellingly.
Right. So it's like there's a lot of talent at work on this show, as there was on PLL. There's a lot of good characters. There's a lot of good ideas. And it's just like, it just sort of gets bogged down into the soap opera stuff or into the week-to-week narrative. And it just doesn't really, sometimes the episodes are pretty good, but sometimes they just, you know, we really can't follow any of the details of the stuff too carefully because it's either predictable or it's just not that interesting, or the characters don't even seem that interested in it. And it's hard to sort of care about the stakes when, like, certainly the emotional urgency of PLL, of like feeling like you're in a horror movie, does not exist on this show at all.
Not really.
And it's much more about like
it doesn't.
Them feeling the sort of personal pressure, which is real,
mm-hmm.
but it's sort of, there is this surreal level of them being like, well, we got to write our papers and also deal with like this murderer on the loose. And it's like,
no, that's the thing is like, no one acts like there is a murderer on the loose.
Right. It doesn't get to the level of what PLL did so well, which was showing characters really be terrified and deal with trauma and the after effects of that.
Well, like, even when Mona gets this, these cupcakes, she's not, I mean, granted, she's experienced plenty of these things before. She's done plenty of things like this to people before. But there isn't any sort of, like, panic or urgency or, like, even when she shows the perfectionists, like, look at this crazy thing that happened to me. Like, they don't seem to really give a shit.
But it's also, it's like cupcakes. It's not getting hit by a car.
Yeah.
And then the getting hit by a car thing is like, oh, well, it's just some random kid, it's an accident, blah, blah,
yeah.
You know, and then she's like back to being caring about others.
So stuff. So the thing that I really want to talk about is that, like, who killed Nolan? And the only thing that I can think of is that it was either one of two people. For a little while, I thought it'd be Taylor. And that she, because conceptually, it's really interesting because she's essentially the series has positioned her as sort of like this mirror image to Allie,
right?
And so,
a twin, if you will,
yes, exactly. And so, wouldn't it be thematically rich to have her be the killer and for Allie to realize that, like, the way that she, like, that her experiences could have made her into a very different person.
Yes.
That's like great. She is this close to being a psychopath.
Right.
Because of all this trauma she's experienced, her inability to let things go, how like manipulative she was, how manipulated she's been, that like sometimes these cycles of trauma lead you to do like really horrible things and traumatize other people.
Right.
And so like how interesting would that be if like Allie's mirror image was actually a fucking murderer?
That would be really interesting.
But the thing that in this episode that I was trying to express, and I couldn't really do it while we were watching the show, which was the timelines don't really, I mean, this is a problem we've had before, but the timelines don't really line up where when Mona, assuming that whoever murdered Nolan is the person who put the cupcakes in Mona's house, that was, I think, also when Allie was with Taylor. The only time that Taylor wasn't around Allie was when she left at that point when Mona came over. Was it Mona came over and it's like, Taylor's alive. I found her and she's here. And then Allie goes upstairs and she's not in her room because she like ran away.
Right.
That would have been the only time that she could have done this stuff.
Right.
But Mona was there. So Mona could have discovered that she went to her apartment. Hence, like, when did Taylor do all these things?
Right. But yeah, I would love if Taylor's the villain.
Yeah,
because that's
it would make sense.
Yeah, that's a great twist, and it's somebody, you know that the show is not going to make like a grown up the villain. Right. You know, it's going to be someone in their age group because that's just what they like to
do. Well, the only other person that has any motivation for this is Dana Booker.
Yeah,
because
it could still be a perfectionist.
True.
I mean, the reactions today, like, so in this, I'm always, you know, looking for these tiny little clues because that's why not. When it's revealed that Taylor is alive, they're like, really? Taylor's alive? Whoa. And it was kind of like, is this like clumsy acting or is this supposed to be indicative of something?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, except, so then, I mean, I guess the perfectionists have the most reasons to kill Nolan. We do have to remember that, like, he died when he was supposed to meet somebody on the roof, and he's like...
Allie.
Yeah, Allie. Wouldn't it be awesome if Allie was the murderer?
It would be. I don't think it will be.
It can't be.
It could be Mona. Who knows? It's probably not Mona.
It's probably not Mona. I mean, it's going to be, like, that's the thing, is, like, who actually has the motivation to do that? How would it benefit someone to kill Nolan? It would benefit Taylor because, like, Taylor knows if Taylor's whole purpose is to take down Beacon Guard,
right?
Then,
which would be because, and so we need to step back a little bit because Beacon Guard, I mean, it's just a surveillance system at a college. Right, it's not a big deal in and of itself, unless, as we know,
yeah,
maybe it's like the pilot project for this larger thing.
Yeah,
right.
Well, see, that's the thing is like, yeah, because in this episode, Allie points to the Beacon Guard thing and is like, is this okay? Like, should I be worried that they're like listening to us or something? And Taylor's response, which is, she's obviously lying or something.
Right.
Is, oh no, it's just like, they know when you leave, they know when it's more like a, having like a smart home kind of thing than it is any sort of surveillance.
But that can't be true because the guy wrote on her wall, they're watching you.
Right. Exactly.
Right. So like, obviously Beacon Guard, and it has all this, like, as Mona discovers in this episode, it literally has like, gait tracking, so yeah, it can tell how you walk. It's like, right, all this like extremely, like, clearly this is like demoing some pretty extensive technology. And that's why Mona gets, right,
so pissed off at Allie, is like, you're losing your sense of awareness and of skepticism here. Like, you just believe Taylor, that Taylor's just telling you that Beacon Guard is not actually what it is.
Right. Right. Yeah. I thought that dynamic was played really well. I like the Allie and Taylor scenes. It's nice to have somebody who Allie can relate to and to be dealing with some of these things that, you know, we really never got a satisfactory characterization on, as far as I'm concerned, in the original PLL. So it's nice to see them at least be addressed again and give the character like an opportunity to grow a little bit.
Right. Mona discovers who Bad Bishop is, and it was who we thought it was, Mason.
It was Mason.
Yeah.
Who, it turns out, is like a shredder on piano in addition to his many other skills.
I know. you know, because music is the art of math.
It's the art of math.
And so is chess. It's the art of math.
Yes. They're both the art of math.
Because not only are you some sort of genius, but you're also model good looking.
Right.
Same with Eddie Redmayne. He shows up. He gets almost gets naked.
Yes. He's wearing his trunks.
Yeah. And then they make out. They start having some somewhat of a public relationship, which is funny because it's like they're Caitlin's being so cautious about like holding hands with him, and she's like looking around, and it's like it doesn't appear that anyone seems to like be looking at you or give a shit.
Right. Right. Yeah, I don't know. The show is not really making us feel. There's the elements of surveillance culture and the claustrophobia in having the song that Dylan records from the vinyl, like having that played at the end. It's like, oh, someone's always watching you. You don't have any secrets. And that, I think, is supposed to be one of the feelings of the show. But we don't really feel, it's just like these little moments, and we don't really necessarily feel sort of a constant claustrophobia.
Right.
You know, especially with the Beacon Guard stuff in the beginning, where, like you said, I mean, Taylor says, it's fine, don't worry about it.
Maybe.
So you don't really get the sense that, like, oh, everyone's being watched, and everyone has to be, like, a lot more careful. And certainly that interrupts your ability to, like, film two characters talking if everyone is, like, whispering all the time.
Right.
But, you know, it also breaks the mood.
Right. I mean, whoever killed, I mean, the thing about the show is, there, and maybe this was the case with Pretty Little Liars, but like you were more willing to go with it, is like, And I almost think that, like, you would learn this from an Agatha Christie novel, which is, like, when you finally realize who the killer is, you have to be able to look back and be like, oh, all of these things add up. I think the major failing of this larger mystery, which most of the characters don't even seem to care about, is that it could be Taylor, it could be Dana Booker, it could be Dana Booker on behalf of Beacon Guard. Like, maybe this is some sort of a giant conspiracy, and Dana Booker is a pawn in, like, maybe Beacon Guard wanted Nolan dead.
Right.
You know, who knows? Right. It could be the groundskeeper maintenance guy that Mona went and saw.
Right.
He apparently knows full well what Beacon Guard is capable of. Maybe he can hack into Beacon Guard's system, which is how he can, you know, knows that Dylan cheated, which is how he knows all the secrets and all this
maybe
stuff.
Maybe he's a spy. Maybe he's working for Beacon Guard.
Yeah, like, that's the thing. It's like, it could be...
We can't really trust...
anybody. Like, there aren't any clues that point to someone in particular.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, even watching that Perfectionist, it's like, we didn't see where they were.
Right.
When Nolan was killed. So right. As far as I'm concerned, we really can trust no one on this show except for Allie.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
we can trust Allie.
Right, we can trust Allie because we know that she.
It seems unlikely that she would show up at this school and start going off and doing murder.
And murdering people, yeah. Well, but that's the other thing too, is it's like, what actually, like, Mona's like, well, I can't get a good shot of someone coming into my apartment, and it's like, well, why the fuck not? I was under the impression that Beacon Guard could see everything.
Right.
So is it a situation where Mona is ignorant of the greater capabilities, where she's been set up to not be able to see this, or is it just plot laziness,
or it's just like a mediocre surveillance system?
Yeah, I mean, who knows?
That must be taken down.
You know, and it's like, I mean, I understand that it's hard to set up a season long mystery like this and to keep it compelling and to also have all these other dramatic things happening. But at the same time, it's just like, I just don't care. Like, who killed Nolan? I don't know.
Well, it's like, is this a show about this, like, secret surveillance syndicate that we haven't heard anything about in 7 episodes? Mm-hmm. Is this a show about, you know, young people dealing with pressure and perfectionism and, you know, what people are willing to do when they're pushed to their breaking point? You know, I mean, that's what it's mostly about, but it also is about these sort of bigger picture things that get teased in the pilot and essentially have not been really addressed at all, and have gone back to these very, like, small stakes, mystery of the week, you know, A leaving cupcakes or whatever.
Well, Dave, I don't know if you were watching the same episode that I was, but I believe that Ava solved the class struggle in this episode.
Oh, did she?
Yes, because one of the subplots was that Ava didn't trust Zach. Is his name Zach?
Who can say? Who can remember?
Yeah.
The guy who was mad.
Attractive, tall, blonde guy.
Sure.
She believed, because he was the guy who was the, he apparently has a million fucking jobs at this college campus, because he was the floor manager, like the coordinator of the fashion show. So we met him last episode. He was, rightfully told Ava to basically go fuck herself when she, like, wasn't getting what she wanted, because he's like, yeah, there are like 6 other designers here, like, get in line. And then we discovered that Ava's dad caused his parents to lose their life savings, and so therefore painted him as the lower class victim of Ava's dad's upper class crimes. And in this episode, he, of course, felt very resentful and bitter towards Ava. And Ava just, I don't think, could understand that. Like, I mean, she's very well-intentioned, but I don't think she really has a grasp on her extreme bourgeois lifestyle that she gets to live.
Until
she realizes... Well, she calls out. So Zach sends her a text that says, I can't make it to our a group art history project meeting because I got stuck at work. And then she talks to who she thinks is a coworker of Zach. And he says, oh, no, Zach's not going to work tonight. And she's like, oh, he's fucking lying to me because he hates me because my dad is a criminal. And sends him some, like, super pretentious haughty text or voice message. And then she realized...
Which is unrealistic because teenagers don't call anyone on the phone.
I know. That was my first thought. Was like, why are you calling this guy you don't even like?
Yeah, that's a lot of using words with your
mouth. Barely talk on the phone to people I do like.
Yes, anyway.
But
magical realism.
Right.
Dream logic.
But she also, you know, like it's very hypocritical for her to talk about moral codes when she has no self or has no class awareness. Anyway, she apologizes to him and ends up doing their project for them, for him and her both. And puts his name on it, and then apologizes to him, and he's like, you know, great, thanks. I shouldn't hold the stuff that your dad did against you, and which is true, he shouldn't. And she's like, you know, great. You know, I would probably do the same thing if I were you. And it's like, that's the whole fucking point, is you're not him, and you don't experience his class struggle at all. Like, you don't know what it's like to have to work three fucking jobs,
right?
Or to you know, not have enough time to just do the work because you're too busy supporting yourself because your fucking parents lost all their money because of your goddamn dad.
Right. But she's starting to, it gives her the opportunity to try to relate by seeing him literally picking up trash, you know,
I know.
Literally.
How fucking cliche is that? That he was literally a garbage man.
Here's this peasant literally picking up trash. And so she does their homework assignment because he had a good idea for it anyway. So, you know,
I forgot. He's literally a garbage man.
So, you know, you get Ava being like doing a good deed.
It's true. I mean, it's hard. You can't hold that kind of privilege against these characters.
Well, and that scene was played to me as like romantic chemistry anyway, as like the beginning of flirtation. Cause this guy, right. You know, this guy is talking to her and realizing like, oh, this is a very attractive woman.
Yeah.
Maybe I should like not be an asshole right now. Right. Maybe there's like maybe I have a chance.
Yeah. It felt very much like one of those moments in Pretty Little Liars where this guy's going to have like a 3-episode arc where he's like dating Aria or something.
Right.
You know, and then he's
Ava, get together.
Well, no, but I mean like it's like in Pretty Little Liars with like one of Aria's like, remember when she dated that kickboxing guy that wrestling, was he wrestling, kickboxing or something? He was like Muay Thai or something.
Yeah, whatever it was.
Yeah, and she had like a 3-episode like I'm in love with this guy kind of thing, and then he fucking got dumped and went away, you know? Yeah. Or like the artist that Spencer was like obsessed with for like 2 episodes when Toby became a cop.
Right. Oh, I forgot about that.
And Toby busted them together. It was basically like, Spencer, what are you doing? I don't know you anymore.
Oh, man. That was a bad character.
Yeah, it feels like Zach is just going to be one of those, like, 3-episode bad character boyfriends who's just going to go away.
That's what you got to do. That's what you got to do on these shows.
So, episode 7. So, next week is 8. We have 3 more episodes to come.
Yes.
Yes. And you know, and then maybe we'll find out who killed Nolan.
Maybe, or maybe this will just go on for another 500 episodes. We'll be still podcasting about it in the year 2035.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't know how. I saw somebody tweeting about how ratings were not super great this week, so I don't know.
Mm.
We'll see what happens.
I mean, it's in that sort of like mid-season lull. I mean, they're only 10 episodes, but you know, that's how shows are now. So I'm sure that Norman's episodes will be some real burners.
Yeah. Well, we can rely on him.
Yeah, that's right. Anything else from this episode you want to mention, Dave?
No, I don't. I think we actually went through the whole thing. I think we did pretty good.
We really did. I don't think we missed anything. I mean, Andrew showed back up. So him and Dylan are back together, which we knew because we went to set.
We did. It's funny because there were things on the set when we did our exclusive visit.
That's right.
There were some things that we saw where it was like, oh, okay, this is interesting, but we didn't have context for any of it.
No.
And so
it's
now,
all starting to make sense.
Now we're realizing like, oh, that was a spoiler.
Yeah.
So
we actually probably know more spoilers than we thought we did.
That's
little spoilers. Nothing like revelatory.
Yeah,
that's
true. I think we were actually on the set for episode 8, right?
Or 9. Maybe.
Was it 8 or 9?
Yeah.
Oh, so we're getting there. Well, I mean, once the episode airs, we can talk about the scenes that we saw, which will be fun.
Right. I think it might be in episode 9 or something. I think they're filming 9 and 10 together. Because those are the episodes that Norman filmed. So they get back together. Everything's great. They danced.
Yeah, that's nice.
It was a nice moment.
It's good.
Even though Dylan knew that he was cheating the whole time. Uploading his 9 megabyte file of deception.
Yeah.
9 megabytes of
his MP3 of lies.
Yes. I mean, I don't know if you want to do this now. Maybe it's too late, but I do want to talk about Endgame at some point.
Oh, yeah. Let's do that another time.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I would love to talk about it because I have probably an hour of things I want to say about it. But yeah, let's discuss that. That probably deserves its own pod.
Yeah.
I did really like it. I felt, oh no, I'm going to get started on it. the one thing I do want to say about it is after the first movie, I felt like it was sort of a lead up into a lot of what happens in the 1980s Infinity Gauntlet comic where, okay, that comic is about Thanos actually has the gauntlet the whole time. He has to fight the heroes. He becomes a god. He has to grapple with, like, what does it mean to be a god? What mm-hmm. is it? How is he gets defeated by his own inner turmoil and insecurities, basically. It's incredible storytelling, super visually, you know, creative and amazing. And so I thought this movie was going to be like, okay, now he's going to grapple with his godhood. We're going to see him dealing with, like, his feelings about killing his daughter. You know, maybe we'll see some cosmic villains, all kinds of. So I had these, like, pretty like specific to the comic expectations about what might happen.
Mm-hmm.
And basically the movie didn't do any of that stuff and went in just like a wildly different sideways direction, which in and of itself was a really good movie. But I'm sitting there like, oh, this isn't what I thought we were going to do.
I mean, I think that there's an interesting discussion to be had about the movie going through and about Infinity War too, going through the character of Thanos, and because I bring this up because at Paste Magazine there was a recent email thread where our editor Josh was asking if we wanted to do being a movie editor. He, of course, came to me and my co-editor and was asking if we wanted to do a ranking of MCU villains and, like, how we, if that's something we wanted to do, how we would do it, you know. And then, of course, it got into a discussion of who would be, like, in the top. And my number one pick is Killmonger, partly because, which it was Killmonger in direct argument against why Thanos wouldn't be number one.
Right.
And my thoughts on Thanos are Killmonger are that Killmonger's motivations are very complex and compelling, especially when you tie it to the position of a POC in society and his inner turmoil. With his need to his doubled otherness, because he's abandoned by both his home and by the society, a white supremacist society.
Right.
And his solution is, I need to gain power, and the only way that I can gain power is through violence. And so his intentions, I think, are noble, which are to empower disempowered people around the globe, but his execution is villainous, and that's why I think he's the most complex and compelling character. Plus, Michael B. Jordan is awesome, but also,
that's, you make a great case.
But the reason that I think that Thanos isn't the greatest villain is because I still can't get over in Infinity War how they removed his, I understand why they did. They removed his motivations from the comics, which were to, and you lent me this comic, so I read it, which were to court Death, as his like girlfriend or his bride,
right? Eventually. The personification of Death.
That he basically wants to impress her, and so he comes upon this idea to kill all these people, and they removed it in Infinity War, and so I haven't really been able to get over this idea that if you can do anything with the Infinity Stones, then why is your choice to kill everybody as opposed to just like doubling the resources in the universe? If the reason that you want to kill half the population of the universe is because the universe can't sustain this many living beings, then why not, if you can do anything, then why not double the resources in the universe?
Right.
Now, that's fine. I can get over it and enjoy the movie. But if we're talking about Thanos as a villain, like, that just removes all complex feelings from him. Because even in this one, where it's like, or in Endgame, where we see that he tried to destroy the Infinity Stones, which in some ways implies that he has some sort of like second thoughts, or that he doesn't want to keep the power that he had, and right. He knows it's bad to do that.
Right. Well, he becomes so.
It's like, why was his solution honestly think that the movie Infinity, and I'm talking about Infinity War, that the movie wants to sell to the audience is like the only choice that he has to accomplish his ends. It's like that kind of straight ahead villainy doesn't add up to the complexity of his villainy in Endgame. And so that's how I'm kind of thinking about it.
Well, I think he's a much more complex and noble character. Not noble, but a more, you know, he has his reasons for what he's doing. And obviously, I think you can say that extremism is not rational. And so for him to hold this essentially extremist belief that this is what I need to do based on my experiences, I think the movies did a good job of figuring out something for him to do without bringing in the literal embodiment of Death as a lover.
I mean, that would have been really, they would have had to set that up for a long time beforehand.
I guess. I mean, my attitude is like, sometimes the comics are trying not to be silly and they're like a little bit scared of being comic books. And it's right. Like, it's fine. Right. Just, it's fine. Just do that thing. It'll be great. Don't worry about it. But something that I thought was interesting about Endgame is that Thanos is a much more two-dimensional character. In the first movie, right. He has a real motivation. When it's done, he goes and rests.
He's done, yeah.
And in this movie, he sees his own future. Mm-hmm. He sees his own death. And it just makes him more villainous.
Right.
It makes him think, oh, well, instead of coming up with a way to not make these heroes angry at me, I'm a tyrannical person, and I have learned nothing. And what I will do instead is try to subjugate the universe.
Well, see, that's the thing is, like, Thanos without the Infinity Stones, as obviously we're talking spoilers, and probably if you haven't seen Endgame, none of this would make any fucking sense anyway. But Thanos without the Infinity Stones is more of a straightforward, just shitty, like, supervillain.
Right. And you could argue, well, he's younger, mm-hmm. he's, you know, whatever. I mean, but the character is a secret. If one of us is dead, I know what's a keeping. I know what's a keeping. I know what's a keeping. For you never tell. I mean, it's just surprising to me that you have this character see his own future, and instead of really being able to learn from it or take a step back and pause and be like the more thoughtful character that we see in the movie, Infinity War, he is not that character several years earlier.
Right.
So I thought that was like a little bit, I mean, I think it worked for the plot, but I thought it was also like a little bit of a cheat as far as making him a three-dimensional character.
Yeah. I'll cut off this conversation. I did want to mention, because we should definitely talk about it at some length, and after I've thought more about it. But one thing that I thought was hilarious is the fact that in the Marvel Universe right now and moving forward, especially with Far From Home coming out, there half of the world's population is 5 years older than the other half of the world's population.
Right. That's absurdly wild.
Isn't that so crazy?
And this is what I was thinking when Spider-Man, like when Peter goes back to high school and he sees his buddy. It's like, isn't your buddy 20 right now?
So every important teenager fucking died.
Right, right. Everybody got winked out who's relevant to the Spider-Man story. How crazy, like MJ and Ned. Like, how wild is that?
Mm-hmm.
And Flash. Every single character.
Yeah.
Like that, I don't know. That's hilarious to me.
I mean, I think it's one of those things where it's just like, you just got to fucking get over it.
They should have come back and had Aunt May have gray hair.
Well, seriously. The funny thing about, like, just thinking about that 5 year, like, Hawkeye's family, his wife gets like basically his wife just reappears, and suddenly her husband is like this weathered, bitter old man with a fucking mohawk, and she's like, "Who the fuck are you? I feel like I just took a nap for 5 minutes,
right.
And suddenly you're this like broken man."
Yeah, everybody comes back. Yeah, there's a lot of interesting storytelling to be done there. I mean, I think this movie, you know, I really liked it, but I think it did have issues with tone and bouncing back and forth between, you know, pretty pure comedy and trying to be like delightful and a romp, and also like being extremely serious about like half the population dying and like character deaths and, you know, having this real conclusive finality to it. And I do think Infinity War was like a pretty somber movie. I mean, it's a war movie, and it's very, it's pretty dark. And this movie was trying to lighten that, but it's like the story doesn't warrant you doing that. And so I was bothered that the movie was too delightful. You know,
no,
it was like too enjoyable at times. It was like, this is not, I feel wrong that you're making me laugh at this.
You know, and I think that that's something that maybe, you know, I think the Russo brothers are good directors. I really do. And they know how to direct a fucking action scene, seriously. But I think the one thing that they're not good at that they haven't really understood is the one thing that I think Taika Waititi understands probably more than any other director in the MCU, which is that humor can be mined from the absurd, especially when it comes to Thor, which is just a fucking absurd story left and right. Humor can be mined from the absurd, but when you're trying to inject absurdity into a situation in order to produce humor, it's just like, you're going to have that sort of like tonal, jarring nature. You know, I think that I think that Thor Ragnarok is one of my favorite MCU movies.
Oh, it's great. It's a masterpiece.
And I think that what I love so much about it is that it is extremely funny, but there are also some very dramatic moments, and it never feels like it's trying too hard during those moments.
Right. Yeah. I really felt like Thor kind of got the raw deal in this movie of like essentially becoming this like drunken clown and played for a laugh. And it's like, this is a 1,000-year-old god.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he is not going to sort of devolve into this level of immaturity.
Right.
You know, especially after everything that he's been through. It felt a little bit fake to the character, even though it was very funny and effective as humor. But it didn't feel like the right way to bring that character to an end, as opposed to what, you know, Tony and Captain America and some of the other characters go through.
Yeah.
And the Hulk, especially.
I mean, like, it just seemed like they just wanted to, like, see if they could have Thor be the dude, pretty much.
Which, you know,
it's funny.
It's charming. I don't know. I feel like I need to go see the movie again because it was so, what happened in it was so surprising and bewildering to me.
That's what I meant when I texted you and I said, this movie is going to break your brain.
Yeah. And I need to see it again sort of to appreciate it more for what it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many wonderful things in it and so many just great, incredible moments. And there are parts where I cried and, you know, it's, I mean, it's terrific.
You know who got the short shrift in this movie is Black Widow.
Yes. I mean, I thought she actually got some really good scenes.
She really did, more than any other freaking movie.
Yeah.
But like when she dies, it's like halfway through the fucking movie. We still got an hour and a half to go.
Right.
And you know, and then by the time we get to the end, it's like we care about Iron Man and Captain America basically meeting their ends. But it's like, you know, you almost need like Scarlet Witch to show up and be like, hey, you guys, you remember that Black Widow died, don't you? And they're like, oh, yeah, shit, Black Widow died. Oh, right. She's not coming back.
Right. Well, there is that great scene with her and with Hawkeye because, you know, Vision's not back either.
Right.
Right. And so they say, I hope they know that we won, that we did it.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, that was a good scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought all that stuff was handled really well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's funny to be griping that the movie was too charming, that it was too enjoyable. But you know, I need to see it again and really absorb it.
So there's news to, there's a point to me saying this. There's news today that the motion picture Sonic.
Yes.
I don't know if it's called Sonic or just Sonic or Sonic the Hedgehog, but the live action adaptation of the Sonic the Hedgehog video game. They released the first trailer, and as predicted, it looks terrible, and everyone was making fun of how Sonic looked, because he looks like a nightmare. And
yeah, he looks so bad.
He's got weird baby teeth, and he looks like something that's going to eat your dreams. And the director of the movie tweeted that they heard the audience response, and they are going to redesign Sonic. So this movie that was supposed to come out in probably like the summer sometime, probably like August or something, will probably get pushed back because they are going to redesign this completely CGI character, which to me is like the epitome of what the audience can now do for these huge multi-million dollar blockbusters.
Right. It's like beyond Snakes on a Plane.
Right, and this might go back to something that, like what we were talking about last week, without, you know, like the fact that like Endgame didn't have a screener and Star Wars won't have a screener and all these other stuff based on like market size and stuff, and how some movies are impervious to criticism. But I feel like when it comes to like a movie like Endgame, it's hard to criticize all these things we're criticizing because it is a multi-billion dollar enterprise that is done by hundreds of people. And so how much of this, I mean, it's done by a lot of people who obviously give a serious shit about what they're doing and are doing really good work, and they're making something that is emotionally satisfying in so many ways. But it's also, it's just like, this is a fucking business. This is a corporation who's putting this together. Like, they are going to screen test the fuck out of every point in this. So you could look at something like the scene in the when one of the directors, one of the Russo brothers, casually mentions that he's gay, and it being like this big big moment in the MCU, I guess, for the first acknowledgement of homosexuality in the MCU. But you could also be cynical and just be like, that is like so calculated. Everything about this is so incredibly calculated. And it's like, what does my opinion even matter? Right. You know, it's going to be what it is.
Well, it matters as far as your consumption of it as a person who chooses what art you watch and enjoy and how it makes you feel. I mean, literally like the bare minimum of your personal reaction to it matters to you.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Right. I mean, that's the thing is like, and that's,
I'm interested in talking about this movie and parsing it out because I've watched all these movies, right, and they're a big part of my movie going experience and my whole childhood and everything. And so I'm very interested in thinking about them a lot and how much I like them or don't like them or whatever.
And I think that's what's important. And we can shift this idea into The Perfectionists and The Pretty Little Liars and all of these TV shows that we've watched and talked about, which is that, like, the most important thing about all of this stuff is that we stop caring about what our opinion reflects of us in this greater social media landscape.
Right.
And you just, like, this is imploring all of our listeners as well. Like what you like, dislike what you like. Stop caring what other people think about what you like or dislike. And just enjoy what you can of this culture while it's still around before the fucking seas rise up and boil us to death.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. We only got another, like, 100 years of this planet being functional anyway.
Yeah.
So yeah, you might as well.
We're in a good spot in the Pacific Northwest. So we're going to be okay.
We're having, like, wonderful, unusually warm May weather in Portland right now. I mean, yeah, it's like, I was going to tweet this the other day that, the nice thing about climate change is, like, spring in Portland is now incredible. It certainly was not when I moved here.
Right. like
it used to be rainy in May. That was a thing in Portland once.
Like Captain American Steve said to Black Widow, he's like, you know, at least the whales have returned to the bay.
Right, right. Cleaner water.
Can we do a quick beer, fake beer sponsor?
Please.
Do you want to play? Let's play Phil. You know, we don't do what we should do every time, which is to thank two people who have helped make our podcast better, which is Phil Nelson, who does our theme song and will do our fake beer sponsor bumper, and also Sarah Trahan, who did our art.
Thank you, folks.
Yes, thank you.
All right, Tom, what are we drinking tonight?
Tonight I'm drinking a Stable Genius. It's a hazy IPA, care of Level Beer, which I've has been a fake sponsor before. It's a great hazy IPA. I like hazy IPAs. I like IPAs. I love Level. They have a great location by my house. They're getting big. Maybe you'll find them in your town soon.
I'm drinking. Well, they are canning now, which is nice. Mm-hmm. Makes them more accessible. I am drinking a LaCroix key lime fizzy water, and I will say once again that the key lime is really just a dramatically better fizzy than the regular lime, which is trash.
I feel like it's like having a spicy queso kettle chips, which is just like, this is obviously the best flavor.
Right, it's obviously the best one. I would rank the LaCroix, I think, key lime, grapefruit, cran raspberry.
Okay.
I'm not really interested in the rest.
Is grape, which one's pamplemousse? Is that grapefruit?
Yes.
Okay, yes.
And that was like the clear, that was the clear winner to me before the advent of key lime.
Mm-hmm. I would agree wholeheartedly with that ranking. I think those top three are right on the money.
That's, you know, there you go.
I think at number four would probably be berry.
Berry. Oh, which one's?
It's pink. It's just like straight up pink.
Oh, I don't know if I've even had that one.
No.
A deep cut.
What can I say?
Well, folks, thank you as always for listening. You can star us on iTunes. You can write a review if you like. It helps us reach more people. You can tell your friends about our podcast. You can tweet at us at PLGM Podcast on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Let us know what you would like us to chat about. If you have any Pretty Little Liars theories or Marvel Comics feelings.
Yeah.
I am thinking maybe we should just start a Marvel podcast because I would like to do that. And I feel like we would have a lot to say and it could be interesting.
I would, you know, one thing,
shows coming out.
One thing I would like to get from you is your ranking of the MCU films, which is obviously something you'd have to sit down and think about.
No, but I've thought about this for my entire life.
I mean, I think I have a pretty solid top five.
I think I
probably name off.
I think Civil War might actually be my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one's incredible. I have to see it again.
Yeah.
Infinity War obviously is like a total masterpiece. I really think that the last couple years of the movies Thor 3, Spider-Man, Black Panther. I'm trying to remember if there was another. I mean, Captain Marvel, Ant-Man and the Wasp. Like, I thought all of those were great.
Yeah.
And Thor 3 is probably my favorite of the group. But, mm-hmm. I mean, I think that whole run, basically from Civil War and to Infinity War, I think basically all those movies are tremendous. And before that, the best of them is the original Avengers, which to me at the time was like, this is the best goddamn movie I've ever seen.
Yeah, some of those earlier movies I would need to watch again. I think my favorite is probably Black Panther. 2 is Thor Ragnarok. And then after that, I'd have to think about it.
I mean, as like a lifelong Spider-Man fan who has suffered through 3 reboots now, like...
I mean, Far From Home was great.
Yeah, I mean,
Homecoming.
Homecoming, yeah. I mean, like, what a special movie, and easily, like, so obviously, like, the best one at merging the sort of day-to-day real life of these characters and their relationships and so on with, like, the superhero stuff in a way that none of the other movies has really made the space to do, to make you care about their friends or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was just, like, such a triumph of giving us a real, authentic Spider-Man story.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's just an A-plus movie.
Adrian Toomes, great, great villain. I think undersung villain.
Yeah, one of the better Marvel villains for sure. And again, like a guy who has great motivation.
Yeah, you know? For sure. Yeah, tied to 9/11, or well, 9/11 ish.
Their version, their version the of 9/11. Version. Yeah.
Did 9/11 happen? 9/11 happened in the Marvel universe.
It happens in the comic. In the comics, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Probably.
It's a good question. It probably does.
Man. In the Marvel Cinematic Universe, New York has gotten fucked up numerous times.
It's a bad time to live in New York.
Thanks all for listening. Who knows what we'll do in the future. We're just going to keep doing this thing, you know, talking about this thing.
Well, we got another month of pod to go.
Mm-hmm. 3 more episodes of the show.
On the Podfectionist. And we'll think about it when the time comes.
Yeah. And then, until then, remember that podcasting is the art of math.